everyone, and welcome to the Angry Robot podcast. I'm so thrilled to have with me here today Molly and Tim. They are both incredible authors, but I'm going to let them introduce themselves and tell us all a little bit about what they've been working on and a little bit about themselves. So, Molly, would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, thank you very much. My name is Molly Tanzer. I'm an author of a couple of novels and a couple of collections. I've most recently been working on a trilogy called The Diabolist's Library that finished up last year, in April of last year, with the final book, Creatures of Charm and Hunger. I'm also the author of The Weird Western Vermilion and the mosaic novel slash collection of short stories, A Pretty Mouth, and on numerous short stories. I'm talking to you today from outside of Boulder, Colorado, where it's not as snowy as I think it is in England right now, strangely enough. And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And Tim, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Tim Pratt. I'm an author of science fiction and fantasy. I've been writing since 2001 or so. Well, publishing. I've been writing since third grade. The most recent books that I've done include the Axiom Space Opera Trilogy for Angry Robot. And my new book is called Doors of Sleep, and it's a multiverse adventure novel. And it's just out this month.
Yes, very exciting. We're thrilled to be publishing it. So it's so nice to have both of you here because I think you both have kind of interacted with being authors in a really interesting way. So am I right in thinking that you both have Patreon accounts, which you use to chat directly with fans of your work and share content? But I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you use it and what it's like having that direct connection with your readers and with your fans, and how it kind of supports you more generally. So, Molly, how do you find that relationship?
I'm actually pretty recent to Patreon, and I use it a lot differently than Tim. I talked to Tim a little bit when I was starting mine out and a couple other different people, but mine is smaller scale than many. The way mine is set up with the idea that sort of I'm actually a slower writer. It's hard for me to churn out content in the way that I'm so envious of for other writers. And so I knew when going into this idea that I was going to have to find something else that I could offer my donors. And so I have a very photogenic cat, and he has ever been very photogenic. Like, it's strange. He's just, and he loves posing for pictures. I've never met an, he knows, I don't know what he thinks I'm doing, but he knows what I want him to do. And I used to put those pictures up on social media, and they were always my most popular posts because he is just a beautiful, fluffy, orange, medium hair tabby cat. And so because those were so popular, I actually used him as the subject of my Patreon. And so it's pictures of him, and sometimes it's other things I'll do for my other tier. And so most people get all the pictures, and then other people get other donor tiers get videos of him being ridiculous. And sometimes I'll do a small reading from my work, or I'll post a progress report on a project that I'm working on. But most of the time it's just pictures of the cat, and it's a way for me to connect with people and for them to support me. And because I was very transparent about how I couldn't really produce an extra short story a month or anything like that. It's just beyond my capabilities. And so it's worked out well to give people snippets of that. They're obviously supporting me because I'm a writer and they want to support my writing as I am in between projects right now. But the benefits are definitely aesthetic rather than deep or emotional or meaningful, like they are for other people with Patreons out there. So
that's amazing, though, that you've got people signing up to kind of support you. I mean, obviously, it's not that much of a hard sell if you have a direct line to a very cute cat.
Yeah, it's been fun. And he does his job really well. As I always tell him, for the first time, he's actually working for a living. So it's it's interesting.
I got a kitten this year who's also a long-haired cat. She's a Siberian called Calcifer.
Oh, wow.
And she experienced snow for the first time today. So I was explaining to her that this was the weather that she's been built for.
Oh,
but she very much disagrees with me. She thinks that she was built for the heating and the inside. So
that's a great name, too. I actually have a Howl's Moving Castle tattoo, so I approve heartily.
She's got a little flame on her face, so I thought it worked very well.
That's adorable.
So, Tim, how do you use yours, and what do you get out of it? Is it nice being able to speak to your fans, to provide them a little bit behind the scenes?
That has been cool. The motivation for me, honestly, was that my first love in fiction is short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I am probably best at writing. I've gotten good at novels, like, and I think George of Fleet.
You're decent, I guess.
Yeah, I'm okay. I think George of Fleet is probably one of my top two or three best books that I've written too. Mm. But I realized, you know, 5-6 years ago, I guess, when I started it, that I wasn't writing short stories anymore unless I got invited to an anthology or something. Mm-hmm. Right? And that was my entire like life before that. Like I would write, you know, 15 stories a year or something, and I really missed it. And so I had to sort of trick myself, because I would always prioritize short stories under stuff I was getting paid for or stuff I was contracted for. So I said, I'm going to trick myself. If I have even a handful of people who are expecting a story from me every month, then I will make it a priority again to write a short story. And it actually ended up, you know, there are much more successful Patreons out there than mine, but I make what I would get for selling a story to a good market every month. Mm-hmm. Right. So the economics of it worked out quite well too. At this point, it's my child's college fund, right? That money basically just goes into an account for him. He's 13, so it has a little time to add up. But for me, the main point was to get back to the thing in fiction that I love the most. But the direct engagement has been really cool too. I have to say, there are a few people who comment really regularly, and people who email me. And in addition to doing a new story every month, I was an award judge last year for a couple of different awards, and I was reading a ton. And sort of as a way to organize my thoughts, I just started posting sort of monthly review roundups. And that proved to be hugely popular. Like just little capsule reviews of the books that I had read that I had finished, because I started a lot that I didn't finish. That's how you make your time work when you're a literary judge, right? You can't finish them all. And they really love that. Like the people on the Patreon love that give and take to talk about books and to get recommendations. So that's been cool too. And I think I'll keep that going.
Yeah, it's a fun way. And I think people always value being kind of told what other people are reading and what's exciting coming up, because you're so plugged in as a writer to sci-fi fantasy and the community. So it often, I don't know, people always ask me for book recommendations and then I can never remember what I've read recently. But it's such a valuable thing to be able to pull them together and say honestly what you felt about each one. In terms of short story writing, I did actually want to ask a little bit more about that, because Molly, you've written quite a few short stories you've got collections and magazines as well. Do you find it kind of scratches a different itch to you for than writing kind of a novel?
Yes and no. Short stories have never been my first love. I'm a novelist at heart. I really love it. I like the sort of way to dig in and stay there, that I get that opportunity in noveling that I don't as much in short stories. But I too sort of got on the invite anthology circuit, and I felt mm-hmm. for a long time like I was sort of churning out work that other people wanted to see rather than writing my own work and finding what I wanted to talk about. And so I actually, a few years ago, decided to stop saying yes to anthology invites, which went against every instinct I had as a writer who likes to write and also get paid, right? But it just mm-hmm. felt like I wasn't spending enough time on the things that I wanted to spend time on, and it wasn't helping me get where I wanted to be as a writer. And so these days I tend to write almost exclusively just sort of things that I want to write. And I'm coming around to the idea of maybe putting out some feelers about anthologies, because I think I've recovered a little bit and some of my chi or my mojo or something, and I can go for it again. But the thing that I've really enjoyed writing most recently was a novelette that is coming out in the next issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And it's called In the Garden of Ibn Ghazi. And it's actually about like a true weird experience that I had, but I made a fictionalized account of it. And that was really, really fun. But of course, it's like 14,000 words. And so it is a novelette. It's got a lot of time to settle in and get in there. And so I do tend to trend longer with my shorter fiction. Mm-hmm. But it is fun sometimes every once in a while to try to churn out like a 3,000 or 4,000 word story, just because it's like a different muscle that you're flexing, and it is good to keep in shape in all different ways.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit. So your most recent novel was Creatures and Charm of Charm and Hunger. Is that right?
Yes.
And it's in the same world, so it's the Diabolus Library universe. So did you study a ton about the era that you were writing in? Because obviously historical settings are so interesting, because you kind of get a sandbox of stuff already presented, but then you have to add your own spice if you're doing sci-fi and fantasy. So how much research did you do to prep yourself for that world?
I did quite a bit of research. So all three books are set in three different time periods, and I did a lot of different research in a lot of different ways for all of them. I actually thought I wanted to be a professor for a long time. And so I come out of academia. I dropped out of my PhD, over 10 years ago at this point. But that I was doing a humanities PhD that focused on 18th century literature, specifically transatlantic literature of that time period that women were writing and engaging with the idea of colonial slavery and the sugar trade and things like that. And so I'm a pretty good researcher. I like that kind of thing. And I enjoy this deep dive into history that I get to do when I'm writing historical fiction. And so specifically for Creatures of Charm and Hunger, I did a lot of regional research. I actually went up and I visited the village in which it is set. And I looked at like the local history and what they were doing in World War II. And then, because it's such an insular family and it is sort of, it was like the worst timing in the world, right? Because it came out in April of last year and it's definitely a, we're locked in this house and we're all getting sick of each other novel. And I was like, well, timing is everything. But it doesn't engage as much with broader history because it is a secret history story of one girl's attempt to stop sort of the last hurrah of what these secret Nazi magic scientists are doing. And so it's a story inside of a larger world, but it's a very personal story in a lot of ways too, in that one of the co-tagonists, I guess, is a refugee from Germany. She's come over and she's staying with her family friends in England. She doesn't know where her parents are or any of these things, but I decided to make her paternally Jewish, and so am I. And so there's like a lot of sort of tension and anxiety surrounding her own Jewishness and her relationship to what's happening with the Holocaust. And that's probably one of the most personal things that I've written. And so the research for that is just sort of my experience as my life, and it's a very internal novel. So
amazing. And Tim, I wanted to speak to you a little bit because obviously Doors of Sleep has such a great concept. How did you come up with this kind of going to sleep travel idea? Did it just occur to you one day?
It did pretty much just occur to me. Upon thinking about it, I think I figured out the sort of pieces that connect to it, and it's sort of a melange. As a little kid, I used to watch the old show Quantum Leap with my mom, which was about a scientist who was working on time travel, and there was an accident, and he ended up sending his consciousness back in time into the bodies of people in different eras. And he would just sort of be projected around the timeline, and he would have to set things right, you know, something that was wrong in someone's life, or some tragedy that needed to be averted, he would change. But he couldn't control where he was going. And the uncontrollable quality that Zax has, I think, probably came from that. And the sleeping stuff, I was thinking about it, and there's the wild card superhero shared world universe that George Martin, Melinda Snodgrass, people like that worked on, that is still ongoing, you know, 20-some volumes deep. Roger Zelazny had a character in the original run of that called The Sleeper, who was a guy who would fall asleep, and he would fall asleep for months at a time and sort of hibernate. And he would wake up physically transformed with a different superpower. And he would try to stay awake if he got a good superpower. If he got some, you know, awesome ability, he would end up doing a ton of amphetamines. And so I think that somewhere deep in my mind, those concepts kind of married and crossed each other. And I thought, wouldn't it be neat? And as for where the parallel universe part of it came, sleeping your way into other worlds, I'm a multiverse junkie. I love multiverse stories. And I love really weird multiverses. Like I can enjoy an alternate history where some tiny little detail changes and things transform, but I much prefer kind of big widescreen bizarre alternate universes where the physical laws of the universe are the same, but otherwise it's diverged so completely that it's not even recognizable as the same universe.
Yeah, it's also, you can see the fun you're having with it whilst you read it.
Oh, good.
Which is my favorite type of book to read, is where you can see that the author has enjoyed throwing things into a pot, so that wherever you go next is like a little bit of a fun surprise. I wanted to speak to you a little bit, actually, Molly, about, so am I right in thinking that you worked on Super Mario Manga Mania?
I did.
Please talk to me about that. I don't know that I have any questions, just that I want to sit here and listen to you say things about it.
You know, so I freelance for Viz Media, which is a large importer of Japanese pop culture, and they translate it into English. And what I do is not translation. I don't read Japanese, and I have a little bit of a background in Japanese language. I took a couple classes in college, and I've always sort of been a fan of Japanese pop culture, and for a while was involved with someone for like almost for about a decade who heavily studied Japan and Japanese and things like that. So what I do is when a translation comes in that needs a little bit of negotiation with putting it into more elegant English, they hand it over to me and I basically do a final editorial pass on it. And it's an interesting thing. Like I've definitely had to sort of use a heavier editorial hand with some scripts and a lighter editorial hand with others. But with Mario, like it was actually a really fun experience because it's a collection of Mario stories over the last 25 years and that Yukio Sawada put out over the years. And it's he collected them himself. And this is his sort of greatest of. And the translator was amazing. I mean, truly one of the greatest translators I've ever worked with, but I sort of have a bit of comic timing as well. And so I was sharpening up the jokes a little bit, but I mean, like, so my favorite thing in this translation was there was this picture of Mario in a squid costume. Like Mario, like he loves to put on costumes and disguises and things, right? And he's eating a bowl of natto, which is a Japanese snack that's like fermented soybeans. And the joke in the book is a Japanese joke because ikanaito means like, we've got to go. And he's saying like, we've got to go save the princess. But the joke he's making is ika natto, which means squid natto in Japanese. And it's like, well, how do you even begin to work on that into English? And this translator with like the grace of Tobias Smollett was like, when there's trouble, call a Mario. And I was like, oh my God, like it was such an elegant solution, right? And so it was really fun to work with him. But, you know, I love Mario and I've always been a big fan of it ever since I was like a little kid. And so there was a scene earlier in it where Mario is missing and Luigi and Princess Peach and everyone are going to look for him. And when they see him, the translator had translated it accurately. And they're like, Mario, it's you. And I was like, no, now the joke is, it's a you, Mario. And so like, you know, we were really working together to punch up the dialogue and just make it as clever in English as it was clever in the original Japanese, right? And that's part of the adaptation shtick, right? Like we're trying to give it the accuracy of we're trying to give it accuracy, but also make it sound as vibrant in English as it does in Japanese, because an accurate translation might not necessarily capture that full picture of it. And so it's been interesting because there's been more of a demand for it. It actually fell out of fashion for a long time because a lot of the adaptation work that people did like in the 90s was censorship. Like, you know, when I was first starting to become aware of Japanese media, they heavily censored like Sailor Moon, which was on American TV at that time. And so like a trans relationship was censored and a queer, like a lesbian relationship, they became cousins. And so there was this reaction against the idea of adaptation because people wanted accuracy. Mm-hmm. They wanted that burst of freshness. And so, but now people, I think now that manga in general is getting a wider audience, people are kind of like, well, what if the pendulum swung just like halfway back, right? What if we made it sound great, but didn't take away anything? And that's been really wonderful to be, it's just such a weird niche little job, but I love it. It's like my favorite thing I've ever done. Except for writing novels, which is deeply personal in terms of the labor that I do. It's just been such a thrill.
It sounds like such interesting work to do. Because I think it's so weird as well. Cause I'm when authors have books in translation, often they aren't really involved much in the process because they don't speak the language. So, you know, you kind of have to have, it's like a step of faith. You have to hope that whoever's working with it loves it and is going to try and be true to it. And there's, I think, a little bit less. So we're actually publishing something this year called The Cabinet, which is being translated from Korean, which we're really excited about. It's just been delivered. The translator's done an incredible job. But obviously, we're doing a pass over it to make sure that everything's in line. There isn't anything that like is hitting wrong because it's just for a different audience.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting area.
Yeah.
I kind of didn't know that there were people out there who were doing this kind of extra pass that you've been working on. Very, very interesting. Sorry, I will stop getting distracted by that.
No, not at all. You know, in fact, I didn't know that it existed either until they contacted me because they needed someone to do an adaptation for the first project I worked on, which is called The Drifting Classroom, which is the 70s manga by a mangaka named Umez. It's amazing. It's about a elementary school that disappears. The entire school and the grounds disappear with everyone who's on campus that day, and it ends up in another place, and where they are is part of the plot. And the translation came back and it was very, very literally done. And they were like, we need someone to just sort of make this sound a little bit more lively. And I was like, sure, I guess for money, I'll do this. And then I was like, oh, I didn't know that this was the thing I want to do with my life. I'm so dedicated to this now. And so it's been really fun. I mean, so I had no idea either until I literally was doing it. And then it was like, wow, my generalist skill set is finally paid off.
So Tim, can you talk to us as well about your the second book that's actually we have the great privilege of publishing this year? So The Alien Stars and Other Novellas. I was so excited when I saw this come up on Kickstarter. But can you talk to us a little bit about how those stories came about? Is it because you just felt like there was so much more in the world that you'd created?
Yeah, well, it's so cool, first of all, that you wanted to publish it. I never expected that. So that's amazing. I know Angry Robots doesn't really do short fiction, so really cool that you wanted to take this chance on me. But yeah, the reason that I decided to do it, you know, I finished up the Axiom trilogy and I wanted to wrap up the main course of the action in three books. And, you know, I couldn't set the entire universe to rights in three books, but I made it clear that they were on the path, right? And kind of the big looming threats had been pretty much dealt with. And, you know, cleanup, they can do the cleanup outside the scope of the actual narrative. But the trilogy is kind of a ragtag crew book. You know, it's about the people who are on the White Raven. Like I've described the series as a, you know, found family group of post-human weirdos fighting alien space fascists.
Mm-hmm.
And every book sort of conceptually in my mind focused on a character or a relationship, right? So the first one was about Callie and Elena, you know, the captain and the unfrozen caveman biologist who they found in cryosleep from 500 years in the past. It was about their relationship. And the second one was a lot more about Steven, the ship's XO and member of the Church of the Ecstatic Divine. So I delved a little more into his life. And the third book, I got into the relationship with the pilot and the navigator, Drake and Janice, who have a very unusual relationship. So all of them, I felt like got some spotlight and got their motivations and their characters delved into a little bit. But that left some great characters. In fact, some of the characters who are most popular with my fans and my readers and the ones that I love the most that didn't get center stage, like Ashok, the ship's engineer, who I honestly had to like cut back on how much he appeared in the scenes because he would just steal every scene that I wrote. Like every scene would just be about his like weird personality, and he would just come to dominate every scene. So I had to pull him back a little. And the alien liar, or the free, the alien lantern, who's one of my favorite characters in the series, who ends up helping the humans against this threat that she had unknowingly been helping the evil alien space fascists. So I wanted to kind of delve more into her, and especially her relationship with Elena, who was a human that she fell in love with. And there are a lot of complicated issues when you're a weird alien who falls in love with a weird human from 500 years in the past. It's a complex relationship. And I also wanted to write about the ship's AI, Shal, who at the end of the trilogy ends up becoming president of a nation state that's also a corporation, the Trans-Neptunian Alliance. And all of those characters were great and vital parts of the trilogy, but none of them got a story that was about them. So I thought, well, what I can do is, I feel like I'm not quite done with this universe. These characters in particular, I want to sort of look at how their lives have changed and what's become of them and give them some time in the spotlight. And I thought I can do that with three novellas. That would be really cool. Also, I wanted to learn to write novellas. Novellas are a form that I love to read, and I've written very few things kind of in that 20 to 30,000 word range. Like I tend to either write stories, you know, that maybe top out at 15,000 words or so,
mm-hmm.
and novels. I think, you know, I've written a couple of short novels that were like maybe 45, 50, but that sort of 20 to 30,000 word sweet spot range, I just had never really done. And I thought it's a form that I like to read a lot. This would be a good exercise for me. Whenever I do a project, I try to think about how it's going to expand my skill set or allow me to do something that I haven't done before. And so that was definitely a motivation too. And I took it to Kickstarter because I was like, well, this is a weird little project. You know, it's something that maybe only the fans would even care about. The trilogy's wrapped up. It's kind of like a weird coda. I'll just kickstart it. And then the response was really fantastic. I think I got double my goal or something. I don't remember, but it did quite well. And then you were interested in doing it too, and getting it better distribution, which I love.
Well, it's just so charming. It was very hard to not be charmed by the stories. So I also, I'm a huge fan of the novella format, and it's something I've been thinking about. AR can do anything in it for a while, because I just think it's such a rich area for creativity at the moment. I think Tor have done some really interesting things with the novella formats of late. And it's really exciting to see, because I feel like it wasn't working for a while. And then suddenly there was this explosion of kind of a bit more mainstream interest, and just so many writers you see kind of growing up using the novella format, or then going back to it when they're not done with a complete world. So it's just such a great format. Molly, have you written anything in the novella format?
Not in that specific length. I have two short novels that are being re-released this coming April, I believe, through the publisher of Vermilion, my first novel. And the first one is part of my first collection, A Pretty Mouth, and it's about 50,000 words. And the other is called Rumbolian, which is, I pitched as Rashomon with fops, and that's also, it's like a tin of sardines. It's exactly what you get. I don't know how to explain it any better.
It's a really good pitch.
I did a little introduction for it, and I was like, in 2013, I pitched this as Rashomon with fops, and I still have nothing more to say about it. So enjoy. So that's also about 45,000 words. So short. I mean, novella is such a broad, like, what people don't even know. I mean, I know that, like, for awards and stuff, there's this length, but I've never known if I should call those novellas or not. But those are the shortest I've written. Mm-hmm. I've never written anything in that 20 to 30,000 word range, and I've been tempted, but every time I try, it ends up being like a short novel or 13,000 words. And I'm like, oh, okay.
I guess you grew.
Yeah,
it's just, it's really interesting as well, I think, the way writers use the short story worlds to kind of try out ideas as well. It's such a rich area. But Molly, I want to talk to you a little bit more about, because your writing seems to tend towards a mashup of genres. You play with a lot of different things in the genre toy box. Is that something that came over time, or were you just kind of a little bit of a generalist? You like looked at the world and you were like, I want it all, but in one book.
That actually is, yeah, it is my generalist tendency, is that humanities background. I've always, it's interesting because the project I'm working on now is definitely inspired by a lot of different genres that I'm touching on here and there, but is more wholly my own thing. And so to an extent was Creatures of Charm and Hunger. The first two in that series are, I think, more responses to other texts. The first one, Creatures of Will and Temper, is a retelling of Picture of Dorian Gray, but with, you know, lesbian romance and sword fighting. And the second one is certainly in the mode of The Great Gatsby, but is not a riff on that. But it is about Long Island, where actually half of my family is from, and I've spent a lot of time there. And so it was a very attractive setting for me, just because I knew the area so well. And so those are much more genre mashups, I would say. And then the third is really more of its own story. Mm-hmm. And that's where I've been trending recently. But no, I always found it very easy to kind of settle into what other people were doing. I love the picaresque, and I love the noir, and I love the sort of these sort of hard modes of storytelling, and then inverting them or playing with them or finding a new place to find representation within them. And that's been really fun for me. But these days I find myself kind of more like, what about a Susan of this element that just sort of is evocative and sets a mood, but then I feel a little bit more confident in my own voice these days. Not to say that using a mashup isn't a sign of confidence. It was something that I felt I was relying on, and I wanted to push myself in a different direction since I had done it so often.
I was just going to tell you that how much I love your covers.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have really good cover luck.
They are so hauntingly creepy, but also very beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I've really been privileged to work with like so many interesting artists who have done so many different things. And it's interesting. Covers are so interesting, and writers usually have like a horror story or two. And I've never had one. I've just been like, oh, I'm, yeah, like they just did a really good job. It's nice when things fall into place every once in a while.
Yeah, it's a funny one because obviously on my side, we do like back and forth. And I'm always really anxious whenever I'm sending cover versions over to whichever author. I'm like, what if they don't like my favorite one? But I love, because we obviously just recently we did Doors of Sleep cover, and I absolutely love that cover, but it's just straight up my favorite color. Putting in emerald green just means that it's going to be my favorite cover for a bit. So
it's such a weird book to try to do a cover for, right? I remember you wrote and said there's some sort of iconic scenes, you know, things that we could, and I'm like, wow, there's like 100 different universes in this book. I don't know. Like, I have no idea.
It's like, how do you put all of those worlds into a cover when you're changing worlds so often? So yeah, playing with that as a concept was fun for the designer.
Yeah, and the solution's great. It's one of my favorite covers. I think it looks fantastic.
Yeah, we're really pleased with that. I think it looks beautiful. Tim, when you were pulling together your Kickstarter campaign for Alien Stars, do you know much about Kickstarters? What is it like trying to fund publication of a book? Because it's such a different side rather than traditional publishing, finding people who want to read it and who are excited enough about it to fund it. Did you do some research before you jumped in? Did you speak to other authors, or did you just be like, fuck it, let's find out what happens?
There was a time about 7 or 8 years ago when I only got asked to do panels or write articles about crowdfunding. Because I've been doing it for a while. Fortunately, now people ask me about other things occasionally. But my first crowdfunding I did in, I think, 2009. And it wasn't through Kickstarter or Indiegogo or anything. I was serializing a short novel on my website, and I just had a tip jar. Mm-hmm. And that made me, you know, a better chunk of change than I had expected it would make me. And then I serialized another book the next year. So basically I had this series, the Marla Mason Urban Fantasy series, that I sold 4 books into Bantam Spectra. And as I was writing the fourth book, I said to my editor, are we going to do more? Because it affects how I end this book, right? I'll either like wrap things up if we're done, but if you want more books in the series, I'll keep it open-ended and like put in like a launch pad for the next book. And she was like, oh yeah, sure. Yeah, we're going to do more. It was, you know, we all really like it in the house. It's great. Well, then she got laid off. It was Black Monday, as it was called in publishing back then in 2008, when like a third of the industry got laid off in a big contraction. I had a new editor who was lovely and kind and helped me through the edits on the final book, but was not interested in continuing the series. But at that point, I had already written it, and it already had not quite a cliffhanger, like it wrapped up the story, but it definitely had, here is what we're doing next at the end. And so I started to get anti-fan mail. From people who loved the series and who were mad that I had ended, how could I end the series that way? I was a monster. So the second crowdfunding serial that I did was okay. I'll do the fifth book, right? I will not be cruel. I will show you what I had in mind. And so I did a book called Broken Mirrors, and that made almost as much as Bantam paid me for it. And I thought, oh, this is a thing, right? It's a small audience, and I'm preaching to the choir. But there is a fan base for this book. Mm-hmm. I actually completed that urban fantasy series, 10 novels in all, and a collection of stories that had an original novelette in it as a little sweetener. And I, over the course of, you know, years, like 10 years, finished up by doing crowdfunding. And I moved to Kickstarter after Broken Mirrors for the books after that. I did them via Kickstarter. Kickstarter was great, so I did other stuff. Like, I had story collections, which I had sold a couple of collections to small presses before, and I was putting together a book called Antiquities and Tangibles, and I talked to a few, you know, of my contacts in the small press editors, and there was some interest, but the amount of money you get paid for a small press collection is very small. And so I thought to myself, well, it's not like it needs a lot of developmental editing. Almost every story in the book has been published already, right? There's a couple of originals, but I'm confident in my ability, and I have beta readers and proofreaders and all that. Could I do this without, like, that bit of editorial oversight? It seems like that would be reasonable. And so I tried to kickstart Antiquities and Tangibles and made more than I would have gotten from a small press publisher. And then I ended up partnering with this guy, John Tian, who does a press called Mary Blacksmith. And he's actually done a lot of my print editions. And his, you know, he sells stuff online, like you can get it through all the online booksellers. But his main thing was he was at conventions with a table selling books. And so I felt like that was a way to then have a connection to the actual tangible physical community too. Obviously, his business model kind of took a hit in the past year, right?
Yes.
Not easy to sell stuff in the dealer room convention circuit anymore. But he was great. We've had a relationship for many, many books, and he's done beautiful. He's a great interior designer too. I am an adequate interior designer, but one of the nice things is having that expertise. So when I came at Alien Stars, this was my, I don't even know what, my dozenth Kickstarter or something for books. And I won't say that it's easy at this point. It is a lot to organize because you have to be an art director, right? Like, I have to do all the things that you do, Eleanor, right? I had to.
Yeah, you just have to put on loads of different hats, yeah, you know?
No, I have to write the thing and then I take it off and I make sure that there's proofreading and like the design elements, and I commission some interior art with from Aislinn Harvey, who's done some other art for me for Kickstarters and stuff. She's great, and I love that you incorporated the artwork into your.
Oh, I love the artwork. I'm so excited to see it in hard copy. I'm really hoping it's going to arrive next week. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's very exciting. I just had her, she lives in my neighborhood, and she came over with her mask on to sign some prints that I made of the art, so I should send you one of the prints.
Yeah, hopefully it will arrive, as I say, the physical copies, and they should be arriving with you fairly fast as well, because I think they courier them from Cornwall.
Oh, all right. But for this Kickstarter, I drew on that experience, obviously. I had to reach out to a different audience because it wasn't that, you know, the Marla Mason, right? That I had a mailing list of 1,000 people or whatever who liked it, who'd given me money. So I was sort of concerned that it wouldn't do as well, but I was really pleased that that a lot of people came on board, even though it was a different direction from the other crowdfunded stuff that I'd done.
I think it's quite a beloved world. Like it's one of the AR titles that when I mention it, people clearly really, really love the world that you built, the Axiom world. So they're really excited, I think, about the concept of returning to it.
I was too. Yeah, I'm glad.
Can I talk to you guys a little bit? How is the pandemic treating you? What are you up to? Are you inside all the time at the moment?
You want to go first, Molly?
Yes, I am inside all the time at the moment. The pandemic has been very difficult for me. My mom lives in Florida. Mm. Her plan last year was to move out here, and obviously that did not happen. Yeah. But I have not seen her since 2019. So that's been really hard because we're both just very... She's in her 70s, and so we're just being very, very careful. And actually, I met someone who lives in the UK and... November of 2019, and went out there early last year to visit, and then that has been the last time I've seen that person. And so it's been interesting. I also got I was working as a barista for several years before the pandemic hit, and I chose not to go back because I just don't think I have the temper. I never had a very good customer service temperament. It's just that my friend owned the shop and she was very indulgent and I made a good coffee drink. And so dealing with sort of the way that people have been in the same, like, I'm lucky to be in Colorado, but I did not go back. I decided to again build my empire of revising translations of mangas and things like that. And so I'm inside a lot. I'm lucky to, you know, have my place and have my photogenic cat and have my friends that I talk to over Zoom and things like that. But yeah, it's been a pretty isolated experience for me.
It's been, I think, very hard. And my friends who have been working retail during this time have, I think it's made them hate a lot of people.
Yes.
So, which I, you know, completely understand. I would be there too. I got into a shouting fight earlier today outside of Tesco. Oh, well, there was just guy who was yelling at the security guard because he wasn't letting, he was like, let more people in. And the guy was like, there's a pandemic.
Yeah.
What do you want me to do? It's just very, very stressful. And Tim, how have you found it? Have you been just writing from home?
Yeah, well, I tell you, it has tested my conviction that I am an introvert. And it turns out, no, I like people a little bit more than I thought I did. My day job is I'm a senior editor at Locus Magazine, the trade magazine for science fiction and fantasy publishing. And I've been there almost 20 years now. And we transition pretty well to work from home. We have one staff member who's in the office to get the mail, right, and answer the phone. And he's there by himself, so it's a safe situation for him. Mm-hmm. We'll drop by to pick stuff up, but basically he's there and all the rest of us are in our houses. And the workflow shifting to digital, not being able to just walk into the other office and talk to somebody, took some adjustments, but we've been doing it since last March, so we have a pretty good handle on it now. So I just have my, my desk where I wrote fiction is now also my desk where I do my day job, which is not ideal. I liked having sort of the psychological division. In general, truthfully, it's not that bad. It's California. The weather's nice. We have a backyard. I have, you know, friends who are by themselves in their houses, right? I mean, Molly's by herself, apart from Toad, apart from the cat. But, you know,
honestly, thank God for cats.
But my wife is here. Our 13-year-old son is here doing online school. So I have not had to deal with the level of isolation that some people have. So I hate to complain, but it has. I mean, it's been a huge change, you know. And last year I was supposed to do a bunch of writing events. I was supposed to go to a literary festival in Spain in July. Obviously that didn't happen. So it has certainly been not an ideal situation. But we're here, we're staying healthy, you know, and you can probably hear me pointing out the things I should be grateful about, right?
It's a little bit of an exercise, isn't it? Being like, well, very privileged. I can work from home.
Yep, exactly. I don't have to really go out. You know, we have a lot of places locally that do like grocery delivery and stuff. So it's been okay.
Yeah, it's been weird not having been inside an office for such a long time. But we had the same move at AR. Everyone pretty much could work from home, but there's still stuff that needed everyone to figure out how to do it. So there's always a little bit of a learning process. But it's been fairly smooth, and everyone's pretty healthy, which is also good. You know, there I go saying things to be grateful for. So Molly, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now, writing wise?
Sure. I have a novel in progress that I've been thinking about for a long time. And once I finished up my trilogy, I was able to start working on it. And it's the first novel I've written that's set in another world. It's a fusion of science fiction and fantasy. It's about a fantasy city that long ago in the history of the city, a spaceship crashed into. And they have had to sort of learn to cope with technology. And also they have become isolated for various reasons. And so it's a city story in this sort of the city is a combination of basically every city I love very much. So there's a lot of Barcelona, there's a lot of London, there's some York, there's some Portland, a lot of Portland actually. And so it's about a ragtag team of adventurers who get asked to investigate a disappearance that is, of course, not all it seems. So it's a little bit of a noir at the same time that it's also a mystery. And part of the mystery is being asked of who the main character really is, because she's not fully sure. And so it's been really, really fun to work on, but it's made me stretch my wings in a lot of ways, because I've never done a lot of the things that I've done with this novel, including building a world from scratch. And I have found myself often wishing that I could just research the city and be like, what a cool detail I can put in here. The history of this place is amazing. But instead, I'm on point. I have to invent it all. And that has been incredibly challenging. And I remain respectful of all people who write true second world fantasy novels, where it's just like, I feel like my brain's on fire constantly with the level of imagination that I'm having to put into it. But it's been a really lovely and freeing experience in a lot of ways. So I know how I sound. I'm totally like, oh my God, it's my new lover. And so I'm in that honeymoon period where I'm just like, every day is a new joy that I get to discover here. And so we'll see where I feel in another 10,000 words, because I feel like I'm probably like ready to be like, oh no, everything is terrible. But I'm really enjoying writing it more than I've enjoyed anything and writing anything. And I mean, I've loved all of my books, but this one feels really special in a lot of ways. So I'm very pleased to be working on it right now.
It must be weird as well, because if it's an amalgamation of cities that you love, but you're writing it in a time you can't visit those cities.
Yeah.
So it's slightly weird and isolating, because as well as creating this new world, which is inspired by these cities, you can't go and walk around them.
It's been kind of fun though. Like, I mean, it's interesting because the novel takes place over the course of only a couple of days. And I'm in the middle of the first day. And I, as I was writing them, going through this investigation, I was like, man, this is like if it, unless it, except for the investigating and like the violence and all the terrible stuff, like this is like my best day. It's like get up, get breakfast with my friends, be annoyed by their ordering habits, like go and visit someone, like have a weird interaction, like do some weird drugs, like go like time for lunch, you know, like, I mean, it really is like, it's kind of really fun to write and to think back on all of these things. And for me, it's hard to write something while I'm experiencing it. I often in retrospect can go back and now, so now actually writing a scene where people are ordering breakfast together while they're trying to have another conversation feels so fun because I have that distance that I didn't have when that would be something that I could do.
Yeah, it's like, oh, exciting. I'm going to pretend I'm at breakfast this morning.
I know. Ooh, let's go over the menu. No. Yeah. Oh, somebody's late. Now they need more time with the menu and everybody's hungry. And it's just like, oh man, I used to complain about this stuff and now I'm like longing for it in these strange ways.
So I get the impression you know London quite well. Just because I'm a Londoner, I would like to know which part of London is your favorite part of London.
Oh gosh, you know, there's an area around the British Museum where I always try to visit every time I go. And there's an antiquarian bookstore in that area and a little Italian restaurant and of course the museums. And that's really, it's where I always end up. And actually, gosh, I always get the name of the bookstore wrong. Is it Mysterious Galaxy or Fantastic Planet?
Yes, Forbidden Planet.
Yeah, I was like, there's like a couple of science fiction words here. Yeah, Forbidden Planet, and it's close to that area as well. And so I really, really love that area. And I've been a couple of times, never for long enough, but I somehow always end up back at the British Museum crying over the Lamassus and wondering about them standing on five legs for all eternity. So that's where I am.
Oh, it's such a good museum.
It's so fraught, but it's so, I don't know. Yeah, it's like one of those like, oh, I'm so grateful to be experiencing this really hard thing as an art historian. Like, oh.
I mean, one has to remain critical, but it is an incredible collection, even if they shouldn't have a lot of it.
It's interesting, yeah. And then like it's like, well, it's free, it belongs to the world. Well, but you stole, I don't know how to negotiate with those things. So I just go and I just look and I try to remember that it is my privilege to view them and that not everyone gets to do that. And I don't know.
There's a really interesting book one of my friends wrote, which is called The Whole Picture by Alice Proctor. And it's so the subtitle is The Colonial Story of the Art in Our Museums and Why We Need to Talk About It. And she does a lot of research and thinking about art and who it belongs to and the state of the museum. It was published last year, I think. It's just quite cool.
Oh, wonderful.
So I'm going to put a tiny...
Yeah, thank you for the recommendation.
I wanted to ask as well, what are you reading at the moment? Is there any recommendations you have for the listeners? Tim, is there anything that you think is awesome that we should know about?
Well, so I spent all of last year reading exclusively science fiction and fantasy, because I was a judge for the Bradbury Prize that the LA Times Book Awards does, which is for best science fiction or fantasy book, right? It's collections, it's novels, it's novellas, it's science fiction, it's fantasy, it's everything. And I was also reading best paperback original science fiction for the Philip K. Dick Award. And I rationalized taking on the Philip K. Dick Award by saying, well, it's all the same nominee pool, right? Like, everything that's eligible for the Dick would also be eligible for the LA Times Prize. So it's not really any more reading. I was completely wrong. It was a ton of
reading. Yeah, flawless logic right there.
Yeah, no, it was brilliant. So I read a lot of books last year, science fiction and fantasy, and certainly had some favorites. The Dick Award ballot just came out, and it has some books that I loved. There's The Doors of Eden by Adrian Tchaikovsky, I thought was wonderful and is also kind of a multiverse book. There was Road Out of Winter by a writer I wasn't familiar with named Alison Stein, which is a sort of dystopian climate change road trip novel, but just beautifully written, really great character work. So that one I liked a lot. Just now, though, I really love reading stuff that's not science fiction and fantasy as well. And I was also a Bradbury Award judge in 2019 as well. So it's really been 2 years of just reading basically nothing but science fiction and fantasy. So now that I'm pretty much done with my award reading, I have been able to kind of stick my head into some of the other genres that I like crime fiction. And I've actually read a couple of crime novels that I liked a lot just this week. There's one called The Talented Miss Farwell by Emily Gray Tedrow, who was also an author I had not read before, which is sort of a white collar crime novel. Obviously, there's some Highsmith influence, right, with The Talented Mr. Ripley. And mm-hmm. about the art world, which is a world that fascinates me that I don't know a ton about. I know what I read in like New Yorker articles about the art world. And so that was a really cool book with a really fascinating main character. And I just read this really cool book by Amy Molloy called Good Night Beautiful. I just finished it yesterday. And it's very much in that super popular, unreliable female narrator psychological mm-hmm. thriller, like The Gone Girl, you know, A Girl on the Train, right? That sort of genre. But it's incredibly self-aware of the genre that it's in. And one of the characters is a professor of feminist literature, right? And so there's a real consciousness about the kind of stories that are being told about these women. And it has twists, like it's part of this subgenre is that you have sort of big twists that reconfigure your idea of what the story is. And I pride myself on seeing twists coming, like I'm very good at it. The first twist in this book absolutely knocked me completely, came out of nowhere. And I flipped back, I read the first, like skimmed the first third of the book again, convinced that she'd cheated, right? There was no way she could have tricked me. Like there must have been some foul play, but no, she played it completely fair and completely like uses all your assumptions as a reader against you. And from that point, I was looking for the twists and I saw the other ones coming, but like a page before they would be revealed, right? Like, so very well constructed. And there's actually a scene where the professor of feminist literature is dealing with a snotty guy who took the class just because there are a lot of women in the class, who says, well, your last lecture almost got me to think I should question my assumptions when I read it. And I was like, all right, I get it, fine. There's no one to stab me in the heart, but yeah, Good Night Beautiful is just really impressed me. It's very well constructed.
Those are good recommendations. I will look them up the next time I need a little bit of a brain break. I like to also try and read outside genre every like a couple of times a month just to reset my brain.
Yeah.
How about you, Molly? Have you been reading anything great?
Actually, yeah. I mean, I finished up The Doors of Sleep this morning to prep for the podcast, and it was so great. I mean, obviously, here we all are, but like, I was really charmed by all the characters and the sort of major key of it, and because I kind of needed major key stuff during the pandemic, and so I read that last week. But the other two, I've been reading more than one book at a time, which is not usual for me. But I have been reading the first five of the James Herriot All Creatures Great and Small books that I didn't realize I had bought all five of them bundled into one, but I'm like, I'm going to finish it. And so I've never read them before, and they're lovely pandemic reading in that you really don't, there's not a lot of through plot threads.
They're quite cozy, I think.
Yeah, they're cozy. Yeah. You can pick them up and put them down. It's like sensible chuckles, you know, it's like nice and relaxing. And so I've been reading that, and I'm very nearly done with it. And then I've also recently embarked on a read along where I'm reading John Crowley's Little Big. And I've never read it before, and I think it's really lovely so far, and I'm really enjoying it, but I'm still only in the early stages of reading it because I've been reading other things as well. So I've been enjoying everything I'm reading. The All Creatures Great and Small really stuck out because over the holidays, when things were stressful because of the holidays and the pandemic and the news and other things that I won't even bring up with the politics over here, like it was just like, boy, I can't concentrate on plots right now. And then it's like, here's 500 pages of not needing to do that. And it's like, thank you so much for this. So it's a really good recommendation that somebody gave me.
I had the same. So over the kind of Christmas period, which was stressful here, because we were told that we were going to be allowed to meet up with households. Yeah. And then there was like a midnight turnaround, which we kind of all saw coming, but still being given it and then it being taken away was a bit much. Yeah. So I just read the Bridgerton novels. The ones that the Netflix just did an adaptation of, and they're that very kind of like classic fun kiss at the end romance where like you enter a really kind of pretty safe world with these lovely genre rules that and you know that stuff is going to be okay at the end, and there was something very reassuring about reading something like that for a bit to turn my brain off. So I haven't read the old Creatures Great and Small. Have you seen the television adaptation?
You know, I've never seen them, and there's the new one coming out too. So I think I might at some point, when I've caught up on TV that everyone's telling me to watch that's coming out right now, I think I might go back and watch those, because it does seem like very adaptable to television, mm-hmm. and probably is very charming in that way. And also like, oh, here's an hour that I can just be like, ah, wholesomeness. So the only problem here is some diseased cow uterus, and it'll probably come out okay in the end. So like, I think I'm probably going to check it out.
I decided I can hack watching the new David Attenborough. Because he is always extremely serious about climate change, and also I couldn't deal with the threat of the cute things being killed, which obviously happens a lot in David Attenborough. I was like, I don't think I'm mentally psyched up enough for this, which gives you an idea of the sort of level of fiction I need to read in my off time.
Absolutely.
Well, it was so great to talk to both of you. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast. Listeners, what I'm going to do is I'm going to link below some of the book recommendations we had on here, but also to both Molly and Tim's new books, which are out at the moment, so that you can click through and buy them. But Molly and Tim, thank you so much for joining me. It was such a pleasure to talk to you both.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was great.